Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's 8:06 on this Monday morning, April 27th. Currently 33 degrees and some snow showers here in Old Town. Heber City reporting 38 degrees with light rain. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Monday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for your Monday. Guess what? We've got some colder air moving in. So those snow levels dropping down to about 6,500 feet as we go throughout your Monday. So that means rain maybe mixing with, if not changing over to snow in the places like Park City and areas across our mountain valleys there. And we could see some accumulations with that activity, particularly above about 7,000 feet where we could pick up anywhere from 3 to 8 inches of snowfall today. Probably lesser amounts as you get down towards Park City itself and into the Heber Valley. Could have a rain snow mix at times this morning, changing over to more rain showers in the afternoon. High temperatures today will only be in the low 40s for us in Park City this afternoon on your Monday. We'll be around 50 for highs this afternoon in the Heber Valley. So a good chance of off and on wet weather potential as we go throughout today, tapering off this evening and tonight. Tomorrow morning, as you wake up on your Tuesday, we'll just keep a slight chance of a few isolated showers in the forecast as we go throughout your Tuesday. Temperatures starting off in the 20s with highs in the mid-50s. For your Tuesday afternoon in the Heber Valley, we'll start off in the 20s in Park City with highs in the mid to upper 40s in Park City. As we get towards your Wednesday, we start to see even drier air working its way into the area. We'll call it partly cloudy skies in Park City on your Wednesday. Highs will climb into the mid-50s. We'll see those high temperatures climbing into the low 60s in the Heber Valley. Once we get towards Thursday and beyond, we're looking at overall drier conditions into the area as a ridge of high pressure returns across the region. That's going to mean high temperatures warming from the 50s in Park City on your Wednesday and Thursday to high temperatures into the 60s as we get towards your Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Meanwhile, for the Heber Valley, we're going to see those temperatures warming from the low 60s for your Wednesday and Thursday to high temperatures climbing into the 60s and 70s as we get towards the upcoming weekend as that ridge of high pressure kind of strengthens across the area. Rain chances slim to none. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. Coming up, I'll be checking in with the Executive Director of Mountainlands Community Housing Trust, Jason Glidden. Later on, Park City Chamber Bureau CEO Jennifer Wisselhoff with her monthly update. And from the Park City Library, Becca Lale, along with Women's Giving Fund Manager Rebecca Blanchette. They'll have an update on this year's Women's Giving Fund author event taking place at the library. In the studio now with an update from Mountainlands Community Housing, I have Executive Director Jason Glidden. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning, Leslie.
So you stepped into this role back in 2024.
That's correct.
Yeah. So what are your top priorities for Mountainlands?
Well, I would say, you know, the first 6 months was really me, you know, trying to get an understanding of the organization and how it operated. Obviously, coming from the government sector and going to a nonprofit, it's a little bit different. So understanding the finances of the organization and getting to know the staff and their roles. And after that, it allowed me to really kind of start to put together maybe more of a strategic plan of where we wanted to go. Really for us, it's continuing the mission, you know, of providing housing opportunity throughout the Wasatch Back. And we've done that through development in the past, and we're going to continue to do that as our main priority. But looking to see how we could help the community and support the community in making changes to help to incentivize affordable housing. So, you know, really trying to take more of an advocate role maybe or a participatory role in local government and state government and even federal government. And looking at policy changes that could help to incentivize affordable housing. So we've really been, you know, doing a lot of work in that area, you know, doing a lot of work in Heber City, working with the Heber City Council and the staff there to, you know, obviously they have a lot of development and growth going on there, and how do they start to plan to make sure affordable housing is part of that?
Yeah. So, I mean, what has changed most, do you think, in that housing landscape over the past couple of years? I mean, is it the cost? Is it the demand? Or, as you mentioned, is it the changes in policy?
Well, I mean, obviously the costs continue to rise. It's continuing to get harder to produce affordable housing. So I think that looking at policy as a way to help offset some of those costs, you know, zoning can be a very easy way for local governments and state, even the state, to look to drop some of those costs. So, you know, I'll continue to push on that try to find ways that, you know, I'm not looking to, you know, increase the density, you know, 10 stories or anything like that. But I think there are some opportunities for us to increase density, to reduce things like lot size that have made it really tough for us to get the density that we really need to see. But I think, you know, the biggest thing that's changed is that actually people are talking about it a lot more. Before, there wasn't a lot of conversation about affordable housing. And now you're seeing it, you know, on an annual basis down at the state level, which that never occurred, you know, 5 years ago. I think that everybody's now feeling the pinch of affordable housing and understanding what happens if we don't address it.
Yeah. How would you describe the current state of affordable and workforce housing here in the Wasatch Back?
I would say, you know, obviously there's been, you know, talk about, you know, how much do we really need and, you know, have we built enough? I continue to look at our numbers. You know, we own almost 11 properties in the Wasatch Back, rental properties, that is. And we run a 1-2% vacancy rate over, you know, over 400 units. So that means each month we probably have somewhere around 10 vacant units. And the only reason we really have those vacancies is because they're all need to it's not like a market rate rental where you just go in and say, I want to apply, and they do a quick credit check, and they say, you're in, you can move in next week. The qualification process is a lot harder in affordable housing. So it takes a couple more weeks to go through that process. So that tends to lead for us to have vacancy for a longer period of time. But yeah, I mean, 10 units over 400, that's a very small amount. And I look at Engine House. You know, Engine House, you know, they had a, I believe they had planned for at least a 6 month period to fill up. And I think that last time I checked, I think they're almost full on the affordable side. So, and again, that takes a process of qualifying those folks. It just doesn't happen overnight. So I still think the demand is high. I do think as far as the rental side, we need to look at AMI levels, area median income levels that are lower. I think that, you know, 80% is probably not going to do it. You're going to need to be at that 60% or below.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the projects you've got, you are working on. We know the HOPA project. This is the redeveloping the Holiday Village and the Parkside Apartments. This has been in the works for years. Where does it stand today?
Yeah. Thanks for asking. You know, this is one that's probably our top priority as an organization. And as you're aware, you know, we've gone several years trying to apply for federal tax credits and been unsuccessful in that. So we really, after this past year of not receiving those, after a third year of applying, felt that it was time that we really took another look at the project and really dug into, you know, really why this project wasn't moving forward. And it really came down to costs, specifically looking at the underground parking costs that are extremely expensive, especially when you're trying to hit the rent levels that we're trying to hit. So right now we're in the process of a redesign. We put out a request for proposal to have a firm assist us in that. So we reached out to some of the, what I would consider best development firms in the country when it comes to affordable housing, and asked them to, you know, provide us with a proposal. So we received 7 proposals, which we're very excited about. There was a lot of interest from the firms to participate with us. And so we'll be making a decision who we're going to be working with. And this is just for the pre-construction side of things. So just the design of the project and then understanding how we're going to put the capital stack together for that. So, but our goal has not changed. We are looking to increase the number of units that are currently on the site. We are looking for a project that is financially feasible, but at that low AMI levels. And at the same time, looking to minimize displacement of our current residents.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the deal, that those current tenants need to stay in place.
Either stay in place, or we need to find them an alternative that's appropriate for them to relocate and until we're done, where they can move back.
Yeah. You were hoping, I think, to add about 250 between the two apartment complexes?
It was just under 200, actually, with the current approval that we have through the Planning Commission. We'll look to target that, you know, but again, you know, parking comes into play and the parking requirements that we need to meet to be able to meet the code make it challenging. And so we need to get creative with that. And that's why we decided to go out and look for the best minds that are doing this on a national level and try to figure that out.
All right. So you just recently missed out again on those low income tax credits?
We missed out last June is when they announced that. So the next application period, I believe, is going to be due in June of this year. And so we probably are not going to be ready for that in time to apply for that. But that those are for 9% credits. There are the 4% credits that are a little bit different. And there are actually usually two rounds of that. So there'll be a round coming up in that May, June time period. And then there's another one in January. So we're hoping that if we were had a project that was ready to go, that we would be able to apply maybe as soon as January if we wanted to look at the 4% credits.
Yeah, so if it's all about, you know, these tax credits about building affordable housing, you'd think that they would want the original, right? Where you're adding almost 200 units instead of a diminished project.
Yeah, of course. I mean, and again, that's for us to have, you know, if we come back with a new design, we want to go to the city immediately and say, here's what we're looking at doing, you know, you know, can we get this within our current approval? Because that would obviously save time rather than having to go back to the Planning Commission. But if we need to go back to the Planning Commission, we're willing to do that and have that conversation. I think that, you know, speaking to some of the Planning Commissioners and some of the other elected officials, I think there's an appetite to look at it and say, okay, how can we help make this project work?
Yeah, when do you think you'll have those redesign plans done?
Our schedules are pretty aggressive, and all the firms that have put in, you know, for the most part have said that we could probably have a new design done within, you know, a couple months. But it's whether or not that's going to meet the current approval, or if we have to go through another Planning Commission process, that could extend it out to maybe up to 6 months, 8 months.
Yeah, because the current approval probably expires. You'd have to get that extended?
We actually did that. We did go to Planning Commission I think it was in December possibly, and we did get that extended just so, you know, we could rely on that going forward.
Yeah, so if tax credits continue to fall through, I mean, are there alternative strategies that could get this project built?
Yeah, I think that that's the other reason we went out to look at partnering with some of these national firms or even local firms that have been doing a lot of development, because I think everybody's seeing this pinch, right? And so there are some folks out there that have started to look at alternatives to tax credits. So we wanted to bring in some of those folks that have been looking at that and say, what do you think with this project? Is there a way to do something different? And so we'll work with them. I'm not sure exactly what that is, but if we have something, we're going to share it with you.
Okay. Let's move on and talk a little bit about the self-help program. We saw a lot of this out in Francis, I believe.
Yeah. We really, this has been a fantastic program. I think we're just maybe reaching, I have to look at the numbers, I didn't have them with me this morning, but exceeding 450 units that we've built with this, and these are ownership single-family homes. And we really focused for the first couple of years really in Summit County. Now our current project is in Heber City and over on Southfield Road near the fairgrounds. We are in group 26 right now that's building currently, and they are hopefully going to be scheduled to be done sometime this summer. The winter wasn't great for skiing, but it was great for construction. So they're a little bit ahead of schedule. And then we have our group 27 that we are finalizing right now. And we are going to be hopefully starting with them in this summer as well. And it's about a year process to build the homes. And we take them in groups of six. So we've still got at least one more, maybe two more groups down in Heber that we'll do after even group 26. So we're at or group 27 rather. So we're actually looking for new participants right now. So if there's an interest from folks, and this is done through the USDA, through rural development, and it gives us access to their 502 direct loans. And the difference with these loans is really that we're able to qualify folks for 1%, 2% interest rates. And their terms can go up to almost to 38 years. So extending the terms, the number of years of the mortgage and also the interest rate, we're able to qualify folks at a very low AMI for ownership, that is. So we qualify folks anywhere between 70 and 80% of the area median income.
All right. So how many total are you going to build in Heber City, and where did that land come from?
So Mountainlands actually purchased that land back in 2017, and we've been working on it. We built some single family homes there to start, a couple duplexes, and now we're building townhomes. We still have 12 townhomes left to build, and I think that we have four single-family lots left and one duplex that we may look at making a triplex, just because we have the space for it and we want to maximize the space we have available. So, but 49 units total in the development. Like I said, we're working on the six right now. We are also working on six that are part of the Crown program. The Crown program is a partnership that we're doing with Utah Housing Corporation. It is a rent-to-own program, and what we use use tax credits, federal tax credits, to help offset the construction costs, and then we qualify folks to come in and rent the homes for 15 years. After the 15-year period, they have the ability to purchase the home. So we just had, five or six come out of out of that 15-year compliance in Heber this year. Those folks bought those homes for $150,000. So it is a way for folks, and these folks qualify at about 55% of the area median income, so much lower than anything that you're seeing as far as home ownership goes. So there is a link on our website right now. We are creating a interest list right now. When we are getting closer to completion for those units, which is targeted, I think, for the end of September, we will start to qualify folks and select the six that are going to be able to move into those.
Okay. So the rent payments that they're making for 15 years, where is that go towards the mortgage? Or
it actually goes towards paying down the construction costs, or the debt that we have to take out for the construction after the tax credits. But also a portion of it goes into a capital fund to help maintain the property. So they're not only paying down that debt, but they're also making sure and they put together a capital fund that will help to maintain the project or the unit going forward.
Okay. And then with the Klein Dolly property, we know that this is kind of a joint venture with Columbus
yep.
Pacific, right?
Yep.
The Basin Rec. And are you involved as well?
Yeah, we're involved in that and also Habitat for Humanity. And obviously the fire district plays a little bit of a role there too, because they are looking at a new location for a new fire station there. So, and we're really excited about this one. I think this is an opportunity where it's a good public-private partnership between some of the local developers, both for-profit and non-profit, partner with the county. The proposal that we put together was to provide both rental properties, but more importantly, a lot more ownership properties in Summit County. So right now, I believe the county is working. There isn't a current zone that would allow for what we were trying to do. And so I know the county is working right now to try to create an overlay zone, an affordable overlay zone, that would not only for this project, but moving forward for other projects. And kind of what I was talking about before is creating these ability to have these smaller lots, which are really key for us, to create these smaller lots, to create these, what I would call in a sense, starter homes, smaller homes that we can then sell at an affordable rate.
Okay, let's see. I mean, Utah lawmakers focused heavily on affordable housing this session. I mean, anything jump out at you? I mean, did we get any new policies or anything that would help Mountainlands?
I would say, yeah, there's a couple things that, obviously a big shift was moving housing over to the economic development, the Governor's Office of Economic Development, where I think it definitely is going to do better there. Housing really does play a huge role in economic development. If you don't have housing, you don't have the workforce, you can't, really survive. So we're happy to see that. I think one particular that I'll bring up is that they did have infrastructure fund that was created to help cities and towns pay for infrastructure so that, that affordable housing could be built. A lot of places, there's the ability to build affordable housing, but the infrastructure is not there to do it. The city or towns don't have the money to go ahead and do it. So this is a loan fund that the state's created for cities and counties to apply for. And I think that's going to be really beneficial. I'm not sure, where it will play into some of our projects, but it's nice to know that there are some funds there to make that happen. So, and again, I think just the fact that they're talking about affordable housing every year and it's becoming a bigger and bigger discussion, I think is going to lead to some great things.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
I just wanted to continue to tell people to go to our website. If you have an interest in the Crown program, we have a link there. If you're interested in our self-help, we have a page dedicated there, and then you can give us a call and find out more information.
All right. Jason Glidden is Executive Director of Mountain Lands Community Housing Trust. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're in the studio now with an update from the Park City Chamber of Commerce and Visitors Bureau is CEO Jennifer Wesselhoff. Good morning.
Hi, Leslie. Good morning.
Let's first get a look at our visitor numbers and a look ahead at this summer. As we sort of figured out, March and April way off due to the warm temperatures, lack of snow, early resort closings. How concerned are you when you kind of look over the last 6 months and see occupancy down? I think more than 10%, I think.
Yeah, right now occupancy is down about 10% for the winter months. But given the snow season that we had, we just got the February performance in terms of sales tax and occupancy tax collections. And I was actually surprised that we performed better than I had anticipated given the snow conditions. So looking at those March numbers, occupancy was down about 25%. And rates are still holding strong. They were flat, just up a little bit, up about 1%. So March was down. We expected that. There were no surprises there. We also expect April to be down about the same amount. We're seeing that in the data as well, down about 20%. We're also seeing average daily rates in those hotel rooms down also for that April timeframe. I think, though, when you look at the last 6 months, you look at the season as a whole with the data that we have now, occupancy for the last 6 months was down, as you said, about 10% at that 44% mark. Generally, we're at least 50% for the winter season. That's what I've been seeing on average since I got here. So we are seeing those snow impacts. And then for the last 6 months as well, those rates are slightly down about 1%, but those rates are still at over $800 average for a room night during that time.
Yeah, so given the fact that we're only 50% full, I mean, during a normal busy winter, why do we keep building more hotel rooms? Because isn't that just going to lower that more and more?
You know, Park City has such an interesting lodging composite. It seems like most of our lodging properties here are condominiumized, so they're really real estate investments. You know, I learned about that when the Pendry was going in, that all of those units were sold before they even broke ground, which is really the investment. And then the incremental revenue comes in through the lodging, the transient room rentals, and those opportunities there.
Okay. Well, with the lower occupancy numbers, what does that mean then for our local tax collections?
Well, looking at the local tax collections, we just got data from Summit County, which represents February. So we do have the last 4 months, or I should say November through February. We have a good chunk of the winter season to see how our businesses have performed. But let's talk about February performance first. February local sales taxes were up 10%, which might be surprising to some of the listeners. Restaurant taxes were down about 6%. Recreation, arts, and parks tax was down just less than 0.5%. And then we are seeing that the transient room taxes, those overnight visitors, are down as well about 7%. I think the surprise there was the local spending that was happening during that time, with the local sales taxes being up so significantly. And when you look at that in the last 4 months, or November through February, so the majority of our winter season, overall, local sales taxes were up 5%. Restaurant taxes were flat. TRT was down about 3%, and our recreation, arts, and parks were up about 2%. So what that tells me is that, you know, maybe when an overnight visitor was coming in, they would normally ski 4 or 5 days of their visit. Maybe they skied 2 or 3, and then they were shopping and spending and eating and enjoying our town and all the great things we have to offer.
Okay, so looking at these numbers then, it's not like you're going to have to lay off people or anything. It doesn't seem that bad.
You know, when I talk to our local businesses, I think they all know how weather dependent we are, but they are very resilient. They were looking really closely in the moment of how to save, how to change employee hours. You know, I think our employees were probably impacted with the amount of hours that they got during this time. And, you know, I'm interested in seeing how this trickles through the rest of our economy as we think about the next 6 months and we think about business philanthropy and we think about employee spending in the community. These are things that are important to us and were drastically impacted this season.
Okay, let's move on. We've got, of course, the big event, the Wasatch Back Economic Summit coming up in a few weeks. When and where?
May 11th from 8 to 5 p.m., the Wasatch Back Economic Summit. It's sponsored by Zions Bank. We're happy to have them again. And this year it's going to be held at the Grand Hyatt in Deer Valley East. They're our largest in the area, our largest ballroom or space to be able to host as many people. We expect about 400 people to attend this event, and we do expect it to sell out. So if listeners are interested in attending, they can go to parkcitychamber.com and click on the events tab, and they can register there. There is a cost to register. It's a $100 fee to register for the whole day, and we really have such an incredible program set up.
Okay, basically, I mean, that covers breakfast and lunch.
And a mixer and at the end.
Yeah, okay. All right. Well, anything you're particularly excited for?
Well, our keynote who will kick off the morning session is Natalie Gochner, the Associate Dean of the David Eccles School of Business, and she's the Director of the Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute at the U. And if you haven't heard her speak, you're missing out. She is just so well-spoken and thoughtful and curious-minded and just so smart. So I'm really looking forward to her presentation. She'll be expanding on the new Utah report that the U completed a few years ago, but we'll be able to expand on some of the new data there. So I'm really anxious for her to set the stage. You know, this is a regional program. We partner with the Heber Valley Chamber of Commerce on this program, and it's really all about the issues that impact the Wasatch Back, but starting at a national level. And I'm really excited that we'll be able to hear a little bit about the national impacts. We'll hear about what's happening at the state with Natalie, and then we'll get into many breakouts throughout the day that are interesting and important to our community.
Okay, so I think you've got a couple of sessions in the morning and then one after lunch, but you're going to have Tom Kelly as the lunch.
Yes, Tom Kelly is going to be there with us. He's going to moderate a lunch panel for us that will include Olympic inspirations and learnings from the folks that were in Milan Cortina. So it'll be a really interesting way to kind of capture some of those learnings. We'll also have Ashley Farquharson, bronze medal winner in U.S. in luge, from the USA team, here with us talking about her experience and her experience in Park City, growing up in Park City, and what it's like to train here and how the community was really part of her journey. This year, we've divided the breakouts into 3 separate tracks. We have one on building business resilience, another on tourism and product development, and the last on workforce and workforce development. So there'll be some really great breakouts depending on what our attendees are interested in learning.
Yeah, who is this for? I mean, who would get something out of this?
It's really meant for our businesses and community leaders in the Wasatch Back. So we promote it mostly to our members, to the members of the Heber Valley Chamber of Commerce, because it's really all about how to react and be proactive in this new environment, this new economic environment. We'll have presentations on what's new, what's enduring, and trying to make sense of all of this economic change that's happening in the country and in the Wasatch Back. I'll be moderating that one with Phil Dean, who is also a professor at the U, a dean at the U, along with Jeff Jones. We'll be on that panel sharing a lot of data and information just about how the Wasatch Back economically is changing. We'll be talking about arts and culture and events as a form of economic, as a driver. And we'll be talking a lot about rethinking talent. You know, when I think about the challenges facing our Wasatch Back, for me, it's really around how do we keep and retain and recruit employees. I know you had the opportunity to hear from Jason just a few minutes ago about housing. And I'm thinking a lot about how do we recruit new employees and where do they live, especially when we have so many new jobs popping up in the Wasatch Back. And how are we going to convince our locals, our workers to work in Park City.
Okay. Well, if people need to learn more or want to purchase tickets, parkcitychamber.com. Earlier this month, you attended the U.S. Travel Association's Destination Capitol Hill in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. What did you get out of it?
It was such a wonderful event. I had the opportunity to travel with the Utah Tourism Industry Association and many of the Utah partners from across the state to really understand, too, what their issues are related to land management, national parks, international visitation. So it was really a wonderful representation of the entire state. We held 6 back-to-back meetings with all of our delegates, either meeting our senators and congressmen in person or with their staff. So we had the opportunity to meet with the staff of Congressman Kennedy's office and Congressman Owen's office, and then meet in person with Congressman Moore, our soon-to-be new Congresswoman Molloy, Senator Lee, and Senator Curtis. So we talked a lot about the mega event readiness that we're all talking about in the U.S. about preparing for America 250. Right here in Utah, we have the 2027 Temple Square opening, which is scheduled to bring millions and millions of people to Salt Lake during that time. And then, of course, preparing for the 34 games and any infrastructure asks that our county and our city will be planting some seeds.
Yep. Nationally, priorities include protecting travel from future showdowns by ensuring that TSA officers and air traffic controllers continue to receive pay during any funding lapses. Any promises made there?
No promises made there, but you know, everyone that we met with did understand the value of both international visitors to the U.S. and domestic visitors. You know, we all agree that safety and security is the utmost priority, but we also agree that keeping our communities open are important. So that was really important. We also spent a little time talking about visas, especially here in Park City. J-1 visas and H-2B visas are really important. You know, at our peak, we had maybe 3,000 workers coming in through that visa program. And there's currently a national cap on that program that we've been advocating for years to increase that cap so that we can get the number of workers that we need here, especially seasonal workers, to help build our economy.
Yeah. Any idea how many visits to state of Utah may have been disrupted by you know, the shutdown and then the no pay and then nobody showing up to work?
It's hard to say. I think our Salt Lake International Airport, and I know you had Nancy on the show recently, they did such an incredible job of keeping the lines moving. And so I don't think we were as impacted here in Salt Lake and in Utah as many of the other communities were. But, you know, it's critically important. We had the opportunity to just talk about the importance of the Great Salt Lake and also the importance of our national parks with our congressional delegation. And they all really value tourism. They value what it brings in terms of sense of pride of our locals and the recreation amenities for our locals as well. And then, of course, the economic development. So it's just a nice opportunity to see them on their turf and have the opportunity to share priorities.
Yeah. What about the international market? I mean, what does that look like? Has that slowed down? I mean, given all of the back and forth on the tariffs and, you know, just we're not going to America kind of attitude? Or
absolutely. Yeah. Across the country, we're seeing declines in international visitation. You know, the communities that really rely on international visitation, like Las Vegas, especially being hurt. You know, for us, we rely on international visitation less than 10% of our market mix. It's an important part of what we do and an important part of who we invite to our community, but it's not a large amount of visitors that are coming internationally. They spend a lot when they're here, which is why we really like to try to attract those visitors. They come when we need them, especially the Mexican market. They generally come in the later part of the season, which helps us finish our season strong. They stay longer, they spend more, and it's an important part of our mix. But we probably won't see an increase in the international market until some geopolitical changes take place. And, you know, we talked a lot about perception, that the perception of the U.S. to the world is really important when people think about where they're choosing to travel. And right now we're finding that they're choosing to travel elsewhere.
I was going to say increasing airfare costs is also something you're going to be looking at, I guess, this summer.
We always look at that. I know the Salt Lake Airport, I'm part of the airport development team where we're always looking at new markets and where we need direct flights. So always, you know, obviously Delta is an incredible partner to us, but we also want to make sure that we have competitive airlines there that are serving other markets and that are also more affordable.
All right. Finally, we've got a upcoming green business program, a lunch and learn. Tell me about this.
Yeah, this one we're partnering with the city on this program. It's a lunch and learn on Wednesday, May 13th. It's from noon to 1. It'll be an opportunity to have lunch with us and really learn about what it takes to be a green business, particularly this time focusing on best place for working parents. It's a program that we help spearhead for the state of Utah that provides strategies to support working mothers. And we're also going to be presenting some new tax credits that came out of this last legislative session that can help small businesses offset childcare costs. So if you're interested, check out parkcitychamber.com. You can register. It's free to attend, and it'll be held at the Park City Library on May 13th at noon.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
That's it, Leslie. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Jennifer Wesselhoff, again, is the CEO of the Park City Chamber Bureau. Well, coming up Tuesday, May 5th at Park City Library, it's an event with author Stephanie Canizales, a lecture and discussion about immigration. And in the studio with details, I have Park City librarian Becca Lail and Women's Giving Fund manager Rebecca Blanchett. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So maybe, Becca, you start with us and just tell us a little bit about what inspired this partnership between the library and the Women's Giving Fund.
Yes, we look forward to our partnership author event every year. We get to focus on a women's focused topic. We usually meet, talk about what topic is important to the Women's Giving Fund. Last year was friendship. This year we're going to focus on immigration based on...
Yes, so last year, Wasatch Immigration Project, as many of you know, won the big Women's Giving Fund prize at $90,000, and so we wanted to create any opportunity to highlight the work that Wasatch Immigration Project is doing in our community, so we decided to pursue a book focused on immigration.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about the book?
Yeah. The book is called Sin Padres Ni Papeles, Unaccompanied Migrant Youth Coming of Age in the United States. Stephanie Canizales is a PhD of sociology and a researcher with the Department of Sociology at California Berkeley. She's also the faculty director of the Berkeley Interdisciplinary Migration Initiative. And her 6 years of research followed unaccompanied youth in California and just study their lives, their hardships, their successes, what they need, and is really an observer to their lives. And in her book, she talks about what they saw when they migrated here, why they migrated here, what support that they might need, and some policy recommendations.
So it's a nonfiction book.
It's a nonfiction book. It is an academic book. So some, if you're not a nonfiction reader, you might think it's a little bit heavy and dense. But don't worry. Even if you don't read a fiction book, if we chose it, don't worry, just come to the author event and you're going to love it. She's going to be she's a professor. She's going to be an amazing lecturer. And we're also going to have a community conversation with Wasatch Immigration Project.
Maggie Abuhider will be there to talk about it locally.
Yeah, it's going to be amazing.
Okay, well, as we know, immigration can be a complex and sometimes polarizing topic. I mean, what are you hoping for as part of this?
Right. The library itself, we value neutrality on topics, which is why we loved her research, because she took on the role of the observer. So if you feel one way or the other about immigration, you can just learn about the experience of the youth. I really enjoyed the book because it really opened my eyes. Something that I learned that I wasn't expecting was the labor exploitation of youth migrant workers, because they were often in unsafe conditions, were facing long hours, wage theft, way lower than minimum wage, and because of their status as being undocumented, didn't have a way to communicate that to the government of saying that this is a really unsafe place. And then I also want to just share that I learned that the Department of Labor looks at child violations, and then they've nearly quadrupled since 2015. And states like Iowa, Missouri, Ohio, and Arkansas are trying to pass laws for lowering ages for minimum the lowest age you can start at work and how many more hours you can work. So really we should look at what is allowed by youth in America too, but also she's saying that it's exploitative even more for migrant workers.
Rebecca, for those unfamiliar, maybe you can explain the mission of the Women's Giving Fund and again how this event aligns with that work.
So happy to, Leslie. So Women's Giving Fund is our main mission is that we make high impact grants every year to local organizations serving women plus and children. And Women's Giving Fund is a program at Park City Community Foundation, and part of our mission is to connect caring donors to the causes that they care about most. And one of the ways that we do that through Women's Giving Fund is we host monthly social or service get-togethers. And so this book discussion, we've done it. I think this has been like one of the mainstays of Women's Giving Fund throughout the 10, 12 years that we've been getting together is an annual book discussion.
All right, so the fund then helps bring in the author in this case?
Yes. So we are helping to support financially to bring the author in, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, you mentioned that the immigration was chosen because of the grant given to Wasatch Immigration.
Yeah,
and what have we seen from Wasatch Immigration Project in terms of how that money's been spent?
Well, come to the event next Tuesday, May 5th, and Maggie will be talking about that.
Okay. And what role does the Women's Giving Fund see, you know, philanthropy play, you know, in advancing conversations like this and solutions, hopefully?
Sure. I mean, I always kind of think about, I think we've seen a lot of stories of Women's Giving Fund members. We have 2,400 members now. And we see people coming to these events for their first time and meeting new people. And what we're seeing is that Women's Giving Fund, you know, we're supporting women and children, and so we have a set of shared values, and so people are able to come together and build friendships quickly. And then my hope is always that they are going out and volunteering and giving to other organizations in our community to increase Women's Giving Fund impact and just to make Park City the best that it can be.
What is the status now on this year's grant? I mean, have you already accepted applications?
Yep, so we've accepted applications. Our steering committee is in the process of reviewing those applications. And shortly, so in June, Women's Giving Fund members will find out. So that that steering committee narrows down the applications to three organizations. And Park City Community Foundation gives them a videographer. They put together a video. We share that with Women's Giving Fund members, and they get to vote. So that is coming up soon in June.
Okay. So is this event geared toward a specific audience or just the broader community?
It's open to Women's Giving Fund members and friends and the community. So we did our marketing push through Women's Giving Fund, but it is open to anyone in the community, and we welcome everyone to come and talk about it.
All right. And I guess just the audience engagement with the author would be the Q&A after then, is that?
Yes, there is really being plenty of time for Q&A. We're also having a book signing afterwards, and Dolly's is selling books if you want to purchase your book there. And that gives us some time to talk with the author afterwards.
Okay. Do people need to register or can they just show up?
We are asking for registration. The registration link is on the Park City Library's event calendar. If you just go to May 5 and you'll be able to find the event, which has the link in it. But registration is not required. If you're not sure if you want to come or if you forget to register, don't worry about it. Just please show up and have a wonderful night with us.
Okay. Rebecca and Becca, anything else you'd like to say about it?
I think so. Thanks so much for having
us. Thanks for having us, Leslie.
Okay. Becca Lale and Rebecca Blanchette. Again, this is happening this Tuesday, May 5th at Park City Library. Well, Kevin O'Leary of Shark Tank will partner with the Military Installation Development Authority to build data centers in Utah's Box Elder County. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports MITA leaders say it is the biggest project yet.
The Military Installation Development Authority will build hyperscale data centers in Box Elder County as part of its new Stratos project area. MITA is the state entity created to serve the military and foster economic development. In the Wasatch Back, it's known for facilitating Deer Valley East Village. At a board meeting Friday, Executive Director Paul Morris said Stratos will be MITA's most ambitious project to date.
For many years, MITA itself, this organization, had the number one and number two economic development projects in the state of Utah. And what we're about to talk about is a project that if you took our number one and our number two, added them together and then multiplied them times 10, it will not touch what we're about to talk about in opportunity and benefit for the state of Utah.
Within Box Elder County, the project includes 40,000 acres of privately owned land, 1,200 acres of military and state-owned land, and part of the Utah Test and Training Range, plus military land including the entire Hill Air Force Base, the Falcon Hill Project area, and over two dozen sites around the state that make up the Utah National Guard project area will be associated with the new Stratos project. The developer is O'Leary Digital Utah Development Company, with TV personality Kevin O'Leary, who's known as Mr. Wonderful, at the helm. The project will be marketed as Wonder Valley. He is also developing a $70 billion artificial intelligence data center with the same name in Alberta, Canada. O'Leary told the MITA board Friday the project is an effort to compete with China to power AI data centers.
My job is going to tell the world what we've done here and what we're going to do here and set an example for everybody in America that this is what it takes to compete with the Chinese.
Senate President Stuart Adams, the chair of the MITA board, said, quote, "The country that controls AI will control the world."
We're in an arms race for AI technology, and we need to step up. We need to wake up the sleeping giant of America, capitalism, and expertise, and that's what we're doing here.
Morris said the project will promote AI generally, but also support the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Air Force, and the Utah National Guard.
This still is a national security imperative to get this done.
The Stratos Development Agreement says Phase 1 of Wonder Valley will generate about 3 gigawatts of energy, and the total project will have a capacity of 9 gigawatts. A single gigawatt of power is roughly how much energy a city of 1.8 million people consumes in a year, according to a CNBC analysis. Morris pushed back on common arguments against data centers, that they use too much power and water and don't create jobs. He says the Stratos project will create 100% of the power it needs and use less water than ranching.
And then they, instead of using the evaporative coolers of old data centers, it is this closed loop where they clean the water up and then they run it through to do the cooling, and then they put it back into the aquifer that can go to the Great Salt Lake. They believe that the water rights they're buying, that they will lose less water than was used for the ranching. And so there'll be a net positive to the Great Salt Lake.
At a Box Elder County Commission meeting Wednesday, several residents said they were concerned about how Midas plans would affect their community. Rancher Luann Adams said she didn't fully understand how her family's land would be affected by the project.
Earlier, they said, shh, don't tell anybody. I kept it to myself for a little while, and then anyway, we're not interested in selling our property this time, and we want to be protected for what we have in the future.
She said she was worried about water pollution and noise. Another resident, Rick Ellis, said the lack of transparency concerns him.
We've heard the sales pitch, the patriotic heartstrings. That's all fine and great, but we need to make darn sure that it benefits us.
Tim Munns said he decided to support the project after asking a lot of questions. He said some of his land is included in the project.
But after weighing if or not it could be stopped, by the time we come in there, this goose was hatched and this turkey was cooked, it looked like to me. It was either watch what's happening or be involved. So we chose to be involved.
Others said the economic benefits to the county will be worth it. When phase one is complete, MIDA estimates Box Elder County will receive about $30 million in revenue every year. When the entire project is complete, the county could see up to $108 million every year. The timeline for Wonder Valley has not yet been announced. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.